The court will proceed to the third case of the day, the United States v. Rogers. Mr. Dallaire.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Steve Dallaire and I represent the United States of America in this appeal. District Court below abused its discretion in excluding evidence of the defendant's prior conduct of sexual offenses at his trial for his 2006 conduct, contrary to Rule 413.
Can I clarify something, Mr. Dallaire? It looks to me as though once you kind of cut out a lot of commentary from the district court that really doesn't have much to do with his rulings, that he agrees with the United States, or he agreed with the United States with respect to the 2001 conduct, that it fell within the scope of Rule 413, but then when he balanced under 403, he thought that the prejudicial effect outweighed whatever relevance the evidence had. And then, although it's a little less clear on the count 3 and 4 conduct, the 2005 conduct, he certainly does at least rule in the alternative under 403. So is the position of the United States that Rule 403 doesn't apply at all to Rule 413 cases? And if so, how can you reconcile that with our case law?
Your Honor, that is not the United States' position, nor would we try to reconcile it. The case law is actually the opposite in this circuit.
That's
403
right.
Does apply.
So you agree that even if you won, basically, on the 413 point, and everybody agreed that these prior acts fell within the scope of 413, the district judge is still entitled to undertake a 403 analysis.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And indeed, that's what this district judge did.
I would disagree on that point, Your Honor. There's two different hearings that, as you're well aware, are the subject of this appeal. There's the January and then the February. In the January hearing regarding the 413 evidence, you are correct that the district court did say that in that case it was just a 2001 conviction that the court was considering. The court did, at that instance, say that it fell within the definition of offensive sexual assault. Later in the subsequent, after the case had been severed and the government moved to introduce evidence of the severed counts as well as a 2001 conviction, the district court essentially reversed itself, and for two reasons, actually.
But why do we care if at the end of the day the judge says, well, even if it is 413 evidence, I'm going to exclude it under 403 anyhow? That's what I understand him to have done at the stage that you're now talking about.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the legal errors with respect to the interpretation of 413, for instance, that minors can't consent to sex with an adult, or that the government had to charge conduct under Chapter 109A, and the fact that the court almost exclusively relied on propensity evidence for 413, informs how the court did the balancing test under 403. Because, again, the court focused almost exclusively on propensity evidence and the danger of propensity evidence in excluding the prior conduct, the 2001 conviction, as well as the severed counts related to the 2005.
Well, I think he focused. He said he had a good case without it. That was what he said about the probative side of the point. He said you don't need it, basically, I think.
There was some reference in the record, Your Honor, to the fact that he thought there was other evidence, but I don't think the analysis stops there, because there was an element very keenly at issue in this case, and that is the requisite intent of the defendant in committing the 2006 conduct. For instance, this case is unique because the defendant didn't actually travel with respect to the 2006 conduct, and as you've seen in the record, the defendant therefore had an opportunity to raise and stated that the defendant was going to raise two defenses, independent defenses to his defense, with respect to his defense, excuse me. The first being that he didn't have the requisite intent because he didn't show up. And the second one, which is more novel, is that he knew for the 3 months that he was communicating with the undercover posing as the minor in 2006, that he was actually talking to an undercover officer.
So I have a question for you about Rule 103 on this whole thing. And actually, I was reminded of it really more by the identity issue that flits around in the background of this case. It seems to me pretty clear that insofar as you might have wanted to use this evidence on identity, the district court leaves the door open for you to come back with it. And so under 103A2, or 103A, I guess, really is more it, you don't have a definitive ruling yet on identity, that if he comes in now and starts to challenge his identity, you're free to come back and revisit that, both the 2001 and 2005 evidence. So then the question has to do with intent, and I'm not clear whether maybe it's the same thing with respect to intent, because the judge does say, based on what I don't know, he does say he thinks the government's got a pretty strong case on intent. But if, as the trial unfolds, it turns out that you really don't think so, has he really precluded you coming back to him and saying, Judge, now, you know, it's clear we really do need this 2001-2005 evidence?
With respect to the identity issue, Judge, you're correct that the door was left open with respect to identity at the hearing, certainly in the January transcript from that hearing. As far as intent, that door was closed. And, of course, the government has to marshal its evidence just like the defendant does to prove each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt.
Now, how do you know it's closed? Did he specifically say, and never come back to me again on this? Or, you know, how does he convey that's definitive and not just a guess on how the evidence will develop?
Your Honor, I would contrast it with how he addressed the identity issue and specifically left it open. With intent, he was quite clear, I think, throughout the entire record that he did not think that, first off, I think the door was closed because he didn't speak of it as he did identity. But secondly, Your Honor, he said that the conduct that we were trying to get in as a legal matter wasn't applicable. So 413 was kind of knocked out of the box because it wasn't, in his view, an offense of sexual assault. And therefore, I mean, we already had lost that legal issue, and it's with respect to intent, there was no leaving open of the door, and he had made quite clear that the government would have to bring, you know, the 2005 conduct separately in a different trial, a distinct trial. And again, this is a unique case, not only because it's 413, and 413 allows propensity evidence in offenses of sexual assault cases. But
well,
also
actually, what 413 does, I mean, we really need to start with 401. 401 defines relevance. Propensity evidence is relevant. It can sometimes advance the ball. 404 then removes a certain amount of relevant evidence from the picture unless the various exceptions are satisfied. And then 413 restores back to the 401 position that propensity evidence for this subset of crimes, these sexual assault things. I think that's how the whole thing works. And so the mere fact that it's propensity evidence, I think you're right, under a 413 situation isn't enough to say it's inadmissible, but you don't get to 403 unless you have admissible evidence that might nonetheless be too prejudicial. So didn't the judge, in a sense, have to understand that the evidence was admissible before he could go to 403?
Just so I understand your question, is that with respect to whether 413?
Well, you're saying he made a fundamental, as I understand you, you're saying he made a fundamental mistake in his understanding of Rule 413 by failing to recognize that without consent meant, you know, minors are unable to consent, not the sort of pragmatic view of consent that he seemed to articulate. So I thought you were saying his mistake under 413 tainted his 403 balancing. Is that not right?
In part. I mean, I think that it informs how he viewed 413 in total. I mean, the balancing is there, as you pointed out, Judge. 403 is the balancing of unfair prejudice and probative value. But in this instance, probative value, which under, as you pointed out, Judge, under 404B is the first element you look at. The government could not introduce it for propensity evidence. It has to be a basis other than that. And so it weighs heavily, obviously, under 404, in the 404 context, for unfair prejudice. In this case, the judge did the exact same thing in his 403 analysis that a district court judge would do with 404B, and that is look at the danger of propensity. But under 413, it's much different. This court, even in Doe, had looked at and noted that 413 changed the landscape. The exclusionary rule that's set forth in 404B doesn't apply in the 413 context.
That was 415, but yes, same.
You're saying that 413 changes the 403 approach, but our case law says just the opposite, doesn't it? the 403 is 403, and you go ahead and do 403.
To an extent, Your Honor, I mean, the court and the primary case on this is Doe versus Smith, which is a civil case, but discuss 413 and the provisions of Rule 413 as well. It actually it does recognize a difference, Your Honor, in two ways. One, this court in Doe noted that Congress intended in allowing propensity evidence, and then therefore it was fundamentally different than 404B, and that, two, Congress in passing 413 looked at the very unique nature of these type of offenses and how prior conduct or related conduct of offensive sexual assault are very unique and very probative with respect to the defendant's conduct that he is standing trial for. So I think this court in Doe recognized that it was a...
Well, how about a Hoppatos? That's the leading case on 403, isn't it?
Hoppatos is, yes, Your Honor. I mean, it noted that courts are not stuck to a very rigid format and what factors it can consider, and it gives a helpful guide. But that case as well, I think, as well as this court's decision in United States versus Julian, recognizes the distinction between 413 and 404B is this propensity issue and moving that potentially from one column of the unfair prejudice to the possibly relevant evidence column. And because of that, in the court in Doe, of course, reversed based on abuse of discretion because a prior conviction in the defendant in the civil case in that context was not permitted at the trial, at the plaintiff's trial. And it's interesting, Doe actually, in this court, in finding that reversing and allowing that evidence in at the trial, actually stated that there were two main reasons why that evidence was particularly probative. One is that without it, it gave a fragmented view of the defense sexual abuse of minors. And two, in that case, the defense was essentially that this principal, I'm sure you're well aware of Doe, school principal had set forth a defense that he was just this benevolent educator who was taking care of these kids. That's directly analogous to what's going on in this case with the Rogers case, in which he's saying, one, he never showed up, he was never going to act on this conduct that he talked about at length in 2006, and two, that he would never have this type of sexually charged communications with a minor because he knew it was undercover officer. Both those defenses are thoroughly thwarted by the 2001 conduct where he actually did travel and acted on the same type of sexual chats and emails with a minor, with a perceived minor in that case. And then the 2005 conduct thoroughly rebuts this notion that he was talking to an undercover officer because not 10 months earlier, he was actually unfortunately talking to a real minor who lived in Wisconsin, who was 14 at the time. It makes it, this is a very unique case, and because of these defenses, as well as the nature of 413, it was probative and should have been admitted. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time, and I'll reserve that time unless the court has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis.
Thank you.
Ms. Winslow?
Good morning. At the outset, Your Honors, there's no reason for this court to decide this appeal at this time. It's the defense, the appellee's position that this appeal is premature.
But Ms. Winslow, you made that argument in your brief, but the truth is, even if there hadn't been an assignment to a different district court judge, any district court judge can revisit evidentiary rulings. And so it seems to me the logic of your position quickly takes us to a point where the government would never be able to appeal these evidentiary sorts of things, and that's contrary to the statute.
It is contrary to the statute, Your Honor, but I think this is a unique situation where you have a judge that's, for whatever reason, reached the limits of his patience with the case, and so he recuses himself, giving the government an opportunity to address its arguments to an entirely different forum.
That may be a pragmatic argument, but the law on reconsideration of matters before a single court, let's say within a single district court, isn't so personality driven. You know, a single district court judge can reconsider a ruling, or people sometimes become ill and things will be assigned to another judge, or in this instance it happens to be a recusal for whatever reason. But we attempt to speak of the district court, which is whose business is being handled by various officers of that court. And I'm just, again, I don't see a legal way to say, oh, well, we all know that, you know, Judge Shader was through with these people, and so now we'll give it to Judge X. That doesn't seem to me something this court can do.
Well, Your Honor, I won't dwell on that point, obviously. The only additional point I would add is that this is a very discretionary ruling based on that particular judge's analysis of the 403 factors, and for that reason, the successor judge could make a huge difference to the government. But again,
we might be of help, right? Because this hasn't really been explored, this tension on 413 and 403, right? I mean, as far as advancing the legal analysis, perhaps it would be an aid of not only the successor judge here, but all judges and the district judges in the circuit.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. But I will move on to the merits of the issues. And
so let me state what I know I'm going to be, to a certain degree, putting words in Mr. Dallier's mouth. But if everybody agrees under this court's law that evidence which would be admissible under 413 may nonetheless be excluded under 403 after the district court undertakes appropriate consideration of 403, then it seems to me the government's concern here is that the district court isn't fully recognizing the admissibility of propensity evidence for these sex crimes. And so here, yes, it is propensity evidence. He did it a couple of times in the past, and we all understand that. 404 wouldn't have let it in, but 413 does let it in. So if the district court wasn't putting the admissibility part of the equation, wasn't setting that up properly, then how can we have confidence in his 403 conclusion?
Well, Judge, I would disagree with that position. I believe that Judge Shader did first find that the offenses in these cases did qualify for admission under 413. It was our position below that 413 did not apply in these cases. Judge Shader disagreed with that.
But what was all that talk about, you know, well, there, you know, there's tender age presumption and there's, you know, there's the formal lack of ability to consent versus, let's say, for the 14-year-old, the practical ability to consent or not. He certainly goes on for a while about those kinds of concepts.
He does. He goes on at length about a number of various parts of this rule, analysis of these rules and their interplay with 404B and 403. But ultimately, his conclusion was that, well, it might not have been a well-written rule, and he certainly
doesn't like the rule, but that's all right.
Well, yes. I certainly don't. But it may not have been well written, but he does believe that the intent was to include these prior offenses. Again, that was not my position. My position was that they did not apply. So in that regard, the judge disagreed with us. His conclusion, ultimately, his legal conclusion, was that 413 applied to the 2001 and 2005 conduct. And as Your Honor very correctly pointed out, he then held in the alternative, regardless, I would exclude this under 403. Now, the 403 analysis in the later hearing, the February hearing, was substantially shorter, less in detail than the previous analysis in January. And part of the reason for that is what we were primarily talking about was a motion to sever.
Right. And could I just back up? I probably didn't make myself clear when I was talking to Mr. Dallier, but if you look at 403, you don't get to 403 until you've decided that you're looking at evidence that's relevant and admissible. And it begins, although relevant, evidence may be excluded if. And so I thought that the judge's 403 rulings had to have been predicated on the assumption that this could all come in under 413.
I very much agree.
Okay.
You don't get to 403
unless... You're not ever talking about...
Well, if we have a judge who says, I recognize the 413 exists, but I balanced it and 403 trumps it. And that's all he says. And it comes up to us on appeal. There's no way for us to reach that analysis, right?
Correct. And I think...
Is that your baseline position? There's nothing for us to do here. If we've got a judge who says, I recognize 413's out of books, but I did 403. That's it. Enters a minute order. There's nothing for a court of appeals to do by way of legal analysis, right?
Well, I think Your Honors could remand it for more reasons. For more reasons.
Well, should that be done in this case? Well, we have a different judge now. We don't have Judge Shader
That's true.
Opening this case.
And I also think that the statement of reasons was very detailed. In fact, it's hard to imagine.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Winslow. As Judge Wood carefully went over the interplay of 401, 413, and 403, do you think this record accurately reflects a judge sensitive to the shift on the propensity issue, which was enacted by Congress with 413?
I do.
Because clearly we all are aware of legislative history here.
Yes.
This is a rule that was heavily advanced by the Department of Justice and significantly opposed by scholars and many judges. So with that backdrop, do you think our record reflects someone who appreciates that shift that occurred?
I do, Your Honor. I do.
Where would you point to it that indicate that?
Well, specifically, I would point to the transcript of the January hearing. That's when Judge Shader asked us all to sit down because we were going to be there for a while. And he went through the legislative history of 413. And he stated very clearly that he didn't like the rule. He thought it was a bad rule. But
that's really comforting to a court of appeals, is it not, when we're seeking to see where a judge is going to make the proper 403 analysis post of 413? I mean, that editorial comment, should we just dismiss that, right?
No, Judge. I think that you should consider it as actually strengthening his analysis after that point. In fact, he said, I don't have discretion to just ignore this because I don't like it. But what I can do is perform a very detailed 403 analysis on the record, which he did. And I'd like to talk about that 403 analysis because I think when you look at it carefully, it would be difficult to find a more detailed, thoughtful analysis of the overwhelming prejudice of this prior 2001 conviction.
But before you get into that, though, I want to put on the table one other concern I have about your side, which is when you're looking at prejudice to the defendant in 403, you're also weighing it against the importance of that evidence to the government's case. And here I'm thinking about, in particular, statements from the Supreme Court in cases like Old Chief. The government has a strong burden of proof in criminal cases. It has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. It's entitled within fairly broad boundaries to put its case together as it sees fit. It certainly did have to prove Mr. Rogers' intent. And just because the judge might think there were alternative ways, I'm worried that the judge might not have been understanding that this was a legitimate way for the government to prove intent.
The government does have a burden of proof to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt, no question there. But what it cannot do is unfairly prejudice the defendant by using evidence that, frankly, I will say, and I'll get into this, I think is of very little relevance in this case for
what's
propensity
unfair
or elsewise.
What's unfair about this propensity evidence?
Well, I'll tell you, and that, thank you for asking, actually. There is a huge difference between the 2001 conduct and the conduct charged in this case, and that is that Mr. Rogers in 2001 got in his car and he went to meet someone who he believed to be an underage individual. In this case, he did not. And I will say, we're talking about these facts as if they've been established before a jury, but they haven't. This case has not been tried. You know, the facts are still just our position. They're what we believe the government will present, but they are just our positions. In 2006, Mr. Rogers was communicating online with someone, with an agent, and he declined multiple times to go meet this individual. So it's the government's burden to prove that he intended to engage in illegal sexual conduct or to induce and entice illegal sexual conduct on behalf of this individual. But it's attempting to do so by overwhelming the jury with this prior conviction rather than proving the elements as it's required to in this case. In other words, it's asking the jury to ignore the fact that he didn't travel and infer the previous travel from 2001 into 2006. And for that reason, I think the prejudice is overwhelming. And again, because of this critical difference, the government will point out what it believes are similarities between these two cases, and I think they're meaningless, frankly. But in terms of the relevance to this case, I think it's minimal because of that critical difference. Now, I think it would be unfair, it would be an undue prejudice, and unfair beyond the allowance of the law to allow the government to present evidence of a previous travel with intent to meet the elements of the current travel without intent is our position.
Or lack of travel without intent, I guess.
Lack
your
of travel.
Position.
Correct, exactly. Exactly. So I think that is a critical difference in this case. If Your Honors have no further questions, I will sit down.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Dallaire.
The Court mentioned the legislative history behind this in reference to the passage of Rule 413, and I'll just...
Well, I only mentioned because it's been mentioned below, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Right. And there's one...
I'm not expressing a view...
No, I understand that just
not myself. Yeah.
A lead, and this Court in Doe noted that Congress, in passing 413, had stated that, you know, these type of offenses, offenses of sexual assault, have exceptional probative value because it shows an unusual disposition of the defendant that simply does not exist in ordinary people. And that was the intent of Congress, and one of the primary focus of Congress in passing Rule 413, and frankly, it was in the government's briefs, but was never even recognized or considered by the district court below. With respect to the nature of the record and counsel's reference, this being a very thorough record below, it's a very thorough record under 404B, obviously, with respect to the weighing, and it is very thorough with 404B, perhaps, but not with respect to 413. There's reference to the government's proof with respect to intent by opposing counsel. In intent, the government does not have to show, as this Court well knows, and it was laid out in the Doe case, government doesn't have to show that the defendant traveled, just say the requisite intent to solicit the minor, in this case, in 2006. And the 2001 conduct is highly probative of his intent in 2006, because in 2001 he again got online, chatted with what he thought was a minor, and then shortly thereafter went and met up with that person and was arrested walking into the residence that the minor had given him. But it doesn't end there. You have a five-year period here where the defendant has three separate offenses of sexual assault. The government's trying to get in and was precluded from getting in the 2001 conviction, but also the 2005 conduct, which happened months earlier and related to an actual minor, which again refutes the notion that he would not have these type of the inference they're trying to draw from him talking, knowing that he was talking to an undercover officer, is clearly the inference that he would never have had such conversations if he knew it was a real minor. See that my time's up. If you don't have any questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, Dallaire. Thanks to all counsel. Case is taken under advisement.